Welcome to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. Today, I am here without Laurie Harrison because she is off to France again. But we are very fortunate having Janet Balzer with us, who will introduce today's guest.
I have Larry Cochran here today, and he was born on Lopez, and he would like to tell us a little bit about growing up and becoming an adult here on Lopez. Hello, Larry.
Hello, thank you for having me. Well, I guess in the beginning, my great-grandfather came here in 1883, and they homesteaded just south of Spencer Spit. And my grandfather was born out on what was now Salmon Point. My grandfather was born on that homestead. My father was born on Salmon Point. And I was born in the house that I live in now. And my daughter sleeps in the room that I was born in. So that's kind of neat. I like that. And I grew up on the island. I was only gone for a short time when I was in college and for a couple little spaces of no more than about 6 months of my entire life. So pretty much been here full time the whole time. We actually... Most of my life, we grew up right by Humble Lake. I moved there when I was 7. My little brother was born just a couple days after we came there. And what was kind of cool is my sister and brother had the chicken pox, and I had already had them. So I was the only kid that got to hold my little brother when he first came home. So that was kind of cool. And we always had a very close bond, and we lost him a few years ago. So...
You had three people in your family, you and two brothers?
And a sister. My sister is moving back to the island soon, and my brother lives down in Colorado. Moved there a short time ago. But we grew up right there by the lake, and Humble Lake was a big part of our childhood. You know, we fished there and played there and
swam in it
and rode our horses in it. We really never really learned to skate because it was only a few winters that it was really cold enough to really get out there. It would freeze over, but it wasn't safe. So, but we grew up on a little farm there. It started off about 79 acres. And of course, in those days, that was probably about the average size place around. My dad was not a farmer, he was a fisherman. And I started running the farm when I was 9 and ran it by myself when I was 12, with my brothers helping me. We milked cows and had hogs and about a 3-acre garden, and we put up the hay and worked.
And, who taught you the farming?
Well, my grandfather was a big factor in my life when I was little. My dad was off working fishing most of the time, and my grandfather was in his 60s when I was born, so he was pretty much retired, and I just followed him around like a shadow. And he didn't seem to mind too much. He would told me a lot of stories and would spend a lot of time with me. He was, he was an older man until he wanted to stop and rest, and he'd sit and tell me stories and roll cigarettes, and I would listen, and I really acquired appreciation for history at that time. I got it's one thing I've always been involved in my whole life is history, particularly history of Lopez. It's just been fascinating to me to learn about my family, and a lot of the history that I know is oral history. It's as true as the people could tell me and I can remember, but it's as real as I can make it in my mind. A lot of it, other people may take issue with some of the things that I remember, and I'm adjusting it too all the time because I get new information from different sources and find that, well, that wasn't quite right the way I remember it, and so I get to kind of reevaluate everything again. So it's an ongoing process, particularly when you're dealing with an oral history. We used to sit and listen to the old boys tell stories, tell about the island when they were kids, or this cow or this bull or that horse or this car, a lot of boat stories, a lot of fishing stories, and a lot of logging stories. Everybody was involved most of the men worked in either fishing industry or logging industry. Most of the farms here were what I would call more subsistence farms. There were a few full-time farmers, but majority of the men worked among only part-time, and the family kind of ran the farm. That was
now was your subsistence or
pretty much I would say yeah, as far as my folks were concerned. My dad always worked fishing and logging, and like I said, I started running it when I was 12, and by the time I was 15 I had about 35 milk cows and
wow.
Yeah, it was a big job. I had to impress my brothers into working and stuff. They weren't real enthused about it, but they had cows too, so they had to help. And
you enjoyed, that was like something you really enjoyed as a kid?
When I was little, I followed my grandmother Cochran was, she had registered Guernseys, and I knew every cow. I knew, like when I was three, I knew every cow's name, every calf, every, what they, everything about them. I mean, I've always been really just have a real love for cattle, and one of the most fun things I've done recently was driving the oxen at Horstone Farm. That was just a fulfillment of my life.
Something I've always wanted to do. Going back to old times.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do that, and I got to drive them one day there for a few hours, and it was really, really a treat. But we grew up with, I guess we were pretty poor. We weren't very aware of it because we always had plenty to eat and all that kind of stuff. But most of the people here, I think the Depression stayed here for a long, long time, up into the, probably maybe even up into the 50s, because there were still a lot of people who walked. The older people didn't drive. A lot of my uncles all walked. A lot of people, I can remember as a littler kid, not having power in their home, still having kerosene lamps and getting the water out of a hand dug well, pulling it up by the bucket full and stuff like that.
And the women probably making the clothes for the kids.
All my stuff was made when I was little. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you were born in what year?
I was born in 1945, mm-hmm. And I went to school here. When we started school, there was 12 of us in the class, and by the time we got to high school, we were down to five, and there was six boys and six girls that started, and there was five boys when we got to high school, and so we were pretty close-knit guys,
You mean they died, or?
No, they just moved away.
Oh, they moved
they
away.
They just moved off the island for a whole variety of reasons. Probably most of them were economic. Parents just got better jobs, and it was tough here. A lot of the guys came back after World War II and just tried to farm, but there just wasn't enough money in it. There wasn't, they all had families, and dealing with the ferry system and all of that. Everything had to be hauled in, everything had to be hauled out, and it just wasn't enough. Didn't support very many people.
Was this a time that they still grew apples on Lopez, or was that already passed?
That was gone. When they started the big reclamation projects in eastern Washington, that pretty
that
much stopped the fruit industry over
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, by the 60s, all the old farmers, except the real old farmers, were gone. Probably half the land on the island was in what was called a soil bank. It was a set-aside program. They got paid not to grow crops.
Mm-hmm.
And, when you were 70 or 80 years old, that was, you didn't want to be out there breaking your back anymore. By the time I can remember, there were, most of the team, horse team stuff was gone. My mother has told me stories when she first came here in 1944. before I was born. She drove teams to thrashing machines and stuff like that. My dad hated horses. He didn't want anything to do with them. So,
but you stated before that you loved horses.
I loved horses. Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess I got that from my grandfather. But I didn't have to work them either, and my dad did. And you know, as a kid growing up, and so he didn't have to. I didn't have to spend 12 or 14 hours walking behind a team of horses, you know, plowing ground, and he did. I was lucky. Most of my experience with horses has been riding them
and enjoying them.
Yeah, about that time, when I was 7 or 8, my cousin Billy Burt had a horse, and he was one of the. He and Pierre Franklin were two men that rode horses, and of course Roy Rogers was really big in those days, and we all watched that and listened to it on the radio and stuff, and so these were guys that were my heroes, you know, and I always wanted a horse, and I was 20 years old before I got a horse, but I've had one most of the time since then, and I still enjoy them. I don't ride too much anymore. I'm getting a little banged up to do it, but I've gotten bucked off a few times. I can't say I'm a great cowboy, but I enjoy it. And my grandparents had a big chicken and dairy farm, and so we a lot of my early life was spent around chickens and cows, and that's kind of where I started out. I got involved with sheep when I was about 20. One of my cousins was a sheep shearer, and I was fascinated with the process. And when I was 17, and I talked my Pierre Franklin, who was my 4-H leader, into bringing a man to come in and teach us how to shear. And we got several kids in the county, and a couple of older guys that came in, and they did a shearing class. And then I went as an apprentice with Dan Humes, who was from the Chadwick family, and I was his apprentice for 3 years, and learned to shear, and I started doing really shearing on my own. That was in the spring of 62, I started shearing, and I've been shearing ever since. So
that was a good thing to learn.
Well, I probably made half my living out of it, you know, over the whole time. When I started, they were developing a feed that they could give the sheep, and they could peel the wool off by hand. They were starting to do that when I was in Australia. And they've actually sort of succeeded in it, but they still haven't perfected it. So everybody said, "Well, what do you want? You're learning this; it's a dead trade. You know, they won't be doing it anymore. They've got this new thing coming out, and it's never been perfected. And we're still shearing sheep."
Isn't that difficult work? I mean, physically,
it is.
Well, it's
whenever
it's,
I've watched it, it seems.
Well, it seems
whole,
so beautifully easy when you see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a whole pattern to it, and you have to shear several thousand sheep because it gets very rote and stuff. But it's not near as detrimental to. I worked in construction most of my adult life, and it was way harder on me than shearing mm-hmm. sheep. And you know, getting bucked off horses is kind of hard on your body too. So, that banged me up pretty good a couple of times, but. We so much of our life was centered around livestock and work, that we made games out of working. You know, we pretended we were doing things. We sang songs. One of the I do sing. I've sang for most of my adult life. I started playing the guitar because. My dad's friends would come around the weekends, and they'd sit around and sing. And back to Roy Rogers again, you know, the singing cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what cowboys did. They played the guitar
yeah.
and rode horses. So, so I tried to learn to play the guitar, and finally a friend of my dad's taught me a couple of chords, and I would sit there and watch them play, and I learned to play in a group like that just by sitting in a group and playing. And,
uh-huh.
and
do you still play?
Pardon me?
Do you still play?
I still play guitar a little bit. I play mostly bass, and in school I played saxophone, so I still play that a little bit. I can play a few chords on the piano and keep a beat on the drums and just stuff. Two of my children are really good musicians. My oldest son is a very accomplished musician, and my youngest son is a very good musician. My daughter plays 4 or 5 instruments, but she's not as interested in being a musician as mm-hmm. they are.
That it runs in the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. You know, nobody, my parents didn't force it on it, but they made it so that it could happen. And we always had, my wife plays a little guitar and stuff and piano, and we've always had stuff there for the kids to play. They know they were, you know, if they wanted to, they'd just pick it up and play. So that's what's kind of, no real formal training, just learn and do it and have fun. And, you know, growing up was a kid, so much of what we had to do, if we wanted something, we had to make it happen. If you wanted to be entertained, you had to make your own entertainment. Mm-hmm. There wasn't even a restaurant open here in the wintertime.
Were there restaurants around?
In the summertime.
Uh-huh.
When there were very few tourists around. The Islander, there was a restaurant there and a little inn, kind of, it had three or four rooms. And when I was a little older, there was a little restaurant at the ferry landing. And actually, the library building was across the street where the fire hall is now. And when I was probably 6, 7, 8, something like that, there was a restaurant in that.
In the old, which is now the library.
Yeah. That was a schoolhouse before that, mm-hmm. and there were, well, that's a whole different story. We get into all the schoolhouses and stuff. But growing up on the island,
where did you go to school?
I went to school here. There was they had the big main building of the school was, there were 12 grades in that building, and it was about, of about half to two-thirds the size that it is now.
But in the same place.
Yeah, they had the first, we didn't have kindergarten. They had first, second, third in one room. And there was around, I can remember there was about 23 kids in three grades. And then there was the elementary, and there was another roughly 25 there. And then there was the middle school, or junior high, we called it then. And there was, that was just the seventh and eighth grade. And then there was 4 years of high school.
And so was it all in one large building
that
used to be, like, I remember when I first moved here, there was a Quonset hut, which was the gym.
Well, when I first started school, there was just the foundation of that Quonset hut sitting out there, just some concrete stuff that we used to go and play in.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
The bus barn, which is now a maintenance building, I think, mm-hmm. They kept a couple of school buses in. And then when I was in middle school or something like that, they built the Quonset hut gym and the art building. Those both came in, and but they had no heat in them, and it was pretty awful to play in there. Yeah. And there was no room for spectators. There was a line of chairs around the floor, but we played games and stuff there, basketball. I was on the last football team that they had. Until they just started again a few years ago, mm-hmm. I was terrible. You know, I got every play in practice and every play in the games I was in went over top of me, and I had the dirtiest uniform on the team. With regular.
Sounds like you tried hard, though.
Well, I don't know if I tried. I didn't know what I was doing. I was a freshman. I barely knew how to put on the uniform.
Football was all about.
Yeah,
and same with my grandfather had been a really good baseball player, and my
baseball?
Dad. Baseball. Mm-hmm. He was actually offered a pro job back in the early 1900s, but my grandmother wouldn't allow him because they drank beer, chewed tobacco, and cursed. And she wouldn't let him do that. But he was an incredibly good baseball player. And in the early days, I remember there was, you know, as a kid, there was a big ballpark at Odlin Park, and we would all go there on the weekends, and they had an island team, and it was great, you know, really 4th of July and Memorial Weekend. Yeah,
they
and all
had
that.
Bleachers there, you know, they still do, actually.
Yeah, the embankment, the CC boys carved bleachers into the bank. It's still terrace there. As you go up the side, you can still see it.
Yeah.
And there was a refreshment center that was built about halfway down along that side of the thing, and I can remember being in 9 years old and being my first year in 4-H and going to the 4th of July picnic and selling pop and ice cream and stuff in that thing. That's what the 4-H, one of the ways we made money for doing stuff. And
now you've been in 4-H for most of your life, is that true?
I started when I was 9, and I was in there for 9 years as a member, and then I was a leader. In my mid-20s, I was a leader for a little while, and then I stopped and then but I came back here and lead. I've been a leader now for I think it's a long time.
Long
30 some years.
When you were a child, would you take stuff to the county fair as a 4-H person?
Yeah, I hauled in lots of stuff. I was really involved in dairy cattle, and I did. I think my first year I had a sheep. I raised a lamb on a bottle or something, but it was bad. And most of my stuff was I would buy day old calves from the sale barn and raise them up. And so I was in there for a long 5-6 years before I ever got a blue ribbon. I never had that good of animals to start off, but I had some great people who mentored me: Pierre Franklin and Otto Kiergaard, Romain Ritchie, Bill McCauley. All these guys helped me a lot, let me follow them around and learn, and had took the time to explain stuff to me and tell me why this animal was better than that one, or what was going on here, or about crops and stuff. One of my first jobs was sowing grain sacks on Romain Ritchie's combine. When he was combining grain, they would combine the grain, they'd cut it, and it would be, the grain would, the straw went out the back, and the grain came down the chute and filled up these burlap bags. And then you had to, very quickly, you'd flip the lever and it would start filling the next sack. You had to get that off and get it sewn up tight and slide it down the chute and before the next sack got filled.
And how old were you about?
Oh, I was 10 maybe. Mm-hmm. 10,
and you were
12.
Sewing, of course, by hand, not with a machine.
Yeah, you had a sack needle. Mm-hmm. You made kind of a half hitch on the ear, and then you did a couple of twists, a whip stitch down the top, and then another half hitch on the other end.
See, the proper terms.
Yes.
Slid it down the thing, and then you got $1.25 an hour. That's what I remember is when I was working, and that didn't matter whether you were digging a ditch or bucking bales or doing that kind of work or whatever. That's when I started shearing sheep. I remember I got 65 cents a head, and by the time I finished my first year, I could do 30 a day, and that was more money than my dad made.
That was good money.
Yeah. Yeah. In 1962, 63, that was more money than my dad could make. Yeah. And we started about the 15th of April, and we'd shear about till about the 15th of June, almost every day. Wow. That's what we did, and. Of course, we were all growing up. We all worked on. It was kind of a rite of passage to work on the reef net gears. There used to be three of them outside of Lopez, and we would go. Old Ed Franklin had the outside gear, and that's kind of where most of the guys started, because it wasn't a very good fishing spot, and you had to kind of learn your trade and learn what was going on, and then you worked your way up and got onto a better gear as the guys moved on and went on to other things. And so I worked there for 2 summers, and then I went on a purse seiner and worked out there.
Did your father encourage the fishing, since he was a fisherman?
He didn't. I don't think he really cared what we did. He never said anything to me about it. He was like I said, he wasn't around a lot of the time. In the winter, he was there, but he was in the woods. He would go to the woods about 7 in the morning, and when he came home about 5, he would eat dinner and go to bed because he was tired. And he was deaf and almost deaf, and he was pretty blind and not very communicative person.
Was he the one who had measles as a child?
He did have measles when he was little, it affected him, and very strong. I had a tremendous amount of respect for him, but we were never really close. My grandfather was the one I probably more impact on my life than mm-hmm. my dad.
Did your grandfather live on Lopez until he died?
Yeah, mm-hmm. he did. He actually, when I was in college, I got mononucleosis and had to drop out. I got really, really sick, and so I came back, and I was staying at home, and my grandfather was living on a little cabin on my folks' place at that time, and we got hired to slash the road in that goes up over Upright, not Upright Head, the one on the other side of Shoal Bay. Anyway, we slashed a road in there, and he came in. He was 77 years old, and he just worked me right into the ground. He was incredible.
And what was his first name? I know
Oliver. Oliver Eugene. Mm. And everybody called him Oli. Because there was there were a lot of Scandinavian guys that worked around here in the fishing industry and then the logging, and there was a huge amount of old guys that were old bachelors, or maybe may have had families, but they were the only one left that worked around for guys doing building fences and milking cows and all that kind of stuff, and they got little pension checks, and and there was a bunch of those old boys around the island and stuff that, and they had lots of good stories to tell when you get together, and you know, and like on 4th of July, guys would be sitting around, and we'd kind of sneak in and sit in the back and listen to all the stories. It was fun to do. Some of the guys didn't like it, but I always thought it was really neat to learn stuff.
Now, people always ask, what did you do when you were a teenager for fun?
Well, let's see.
I mean,
we went
that's
fishing.
That's the phrase nowadays.
Oh, still,
know.
Yeah.
We went fishing. We fished in the lake, and we fished in the Sound. Most of the time, we couldn't afford gas for an outboard. So, when we could, we would go water skiing. You know, when I was like a little bit older, like when I was in high school.
Where would you do that?
In Fisherman Bay. Mm-hmm. The Buzzard family had a nice little towboat, and we would all chip in on Sunday afternoons. We'd go over there because we were all working during the week or going to school. And so in the summer, we would go over there on Sundays, and we'd chip in money for gas, and Roy would tow us around in Fisherman Bay. It was great water skiing there. And we fished, and of course, we played basketball and baseball, mostly, you know, we worked a lot. So,
yeah.
I mean, there were some kids that had more time off, but I like I said, I was running the farm when I was all through my teenage years, so I didn't have a lot of, by my own choice, I didn't have a lot of time to be out running around and doing stuff. But when I was old, and before I was old enough to drive, we had bicycles, and we would think nothing of getting on our bike on Saturday. And one of the big fun things is they had dances at Woodman Hall about once a month. And in those days, nobody said too much about you going outside to have a drink. Well, so when they would drink, they'd just leave the bottles there. And that was okay, because Sunday morning, the first kid with his bike there, you could redeem those bottles for a penny a piece for a beer bottle and a nickel a piece for a big pop bottle. So you would collect all these bottles, and the first kid there, you could get rich, you know. So that was where we would go after the dances and get bottles and going down and turn them in. And
so you redeemed them at the grocery store, which was where? When you
down in the village where the fudge company is right now.
Oh, okay.
And there was a store at Richardson.
That was Bill Carpenter's first store.
Yeah, actually at that time it was run by a man named Leroy Jensen.
Uh-huh. The one in the village.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Lundy's had the one at Richardson. And Richardson, you could get everything. You could get a pair of jeans, a flannel shirt, a keg of nails. And if you didn't have it there, they'd order it for you. My grandfather actually bought his first tractor from Richardson.
through the store there, yeah?
Yeah. Well, from the Lundy's.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, you know, they were tied into everything, and all the boats that came in, all the fishing industry from Lopez, all the gill netters and stuff all got their groceries and stuff there, and their fuel. You know, I remember they would come with the fuel truck and bring fuel about once a month to the farm. And also they would have a bag of groceries thrown up on the side of the fuel truck, a box of groceries, you know, with bananas and stuff. They didn't buy a lot of stuff, but they did. They would get things like bananas and kerosene and, you know, flour and sugar and stuff like that. But my grandparents were pretty self-reliant. They grew all, you know, like big gardens, and they had a lot of chickens, and they sold eggs, and they sold cream, and they sold calves. You know, one of the ways that we made when I was running the farm, it was dairy cattle, but it wasn't milk that people were. They sold cream to the dairy to make butter. The milk was the skim milk. Everybody had a separator, and you either turned it by hand. If you're lucky, you had an electric one. We had both. When we started out, you know, my little brother would come off the ground every time the crank would go around. You know, but we'd have to team up. We were so small to make it go around. And you would turn the crank, and the centrifugal force would separate the cream and the skim milk. And the cream they sold, and the skim milk was either fed to calves or fed to hogs. And they raised a lot of barley here. And if you had a lot of cows and stuff, that you know, you'd have if you didn't have enough pigs, Bill McCauley would bring you some pigs, you know. And he bought all. Another way that people made a lot of their income was raising veal calves. And so they maybe would milk part of the cows, but the older cows that were or cows that were hard to milk, or something that kicked a lot, or something like that, they'd put a couple of calves on and raise it up till they were about 3 months old, and then they would sell them. And that was a big, that was a cash crop. That was that kept the money turning over.
Did you ever do that on your?
Oh yeah, I made a lot. I probably made half of whatever I made, more than half of what I made actually from the farm was raising veal, We didn't raise a lot of beef. We raised like one dairy steer a year would go. It was always named Roscoe, so we never got attached to Roscoe, because he was gonna be your dinner.
So would you have to take him on the ferry to sell him?
No, we butchered it right there in the place, and then one of my friends' dad was a meat cutter, and he would come and cut it up on the kitchen table. And we put it in the freezer.
Table. Wow, a big cow.
And then sometimes we would take him to. There was a slaughterhouse over in the head of Fisherman Bay, and sometimes we would have it slaughtered there. But we still had to have it cut up by somebody. If you were good, you know, good meat cutter, you did it yourself, or you got this man Cecil Orchid to come and cut up your beef, and it would take a couple of days, you know, to get it. They'd do up maybe a half at a time, and you know, everybody was trying to, you know, package it and make hamburger. We'd be turning a hand grinder, and you know, that's one of the things we did for fun. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it was work projects, but they were fun things. Yeah. You know, you looked forward to them, and
it was probably a social time. I mean, lots of people doing it, and it's food for.
When I was shearing sheep, it was a big social event. Mm-hmm. You went to somebody's house that, you know, people didn't travel even around the island. I rarely went past the school when I was a kid, except maybe to Richardson's store. Mm-hmm. Probably
not
I could probably
to the
count
Grange or anything.
My parents didn't belong to the Grange, but we had 4-H meetings at the Grange, so I did go to the Grange. But as far as they're like further down, unless at McKay Harbor, I never went to Wattmow Bight until I never was at Wattmow until the day after I graduated. I never had been there. Oh. And we climbed the face of the cliff the day after we graduated.
Go to Richardson sometimes.
We did go to Richardson about once a month. We would go down there and get ice cream cones or blackjack gum.
The only place where you could get ice cream cones.
Yeah. Well, you sometimes could get them down at the other place, but it was a little inconsistent. But that was an event. We didn't eat a lot of. Well, I shouldn't say we didn't eat a lot of sweets because we drank Kool-Aid, you know, which is probably not a good thing to drink. but we didn't have pop. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot of candy. We didn't. Our sweets were canned fruit, home canned fruit, cake. They made a lot of cakes and sweetbreads and different kinds of things like that.
But coffee cakes, yeah.
Yeah, not like the, I know my grandmothers. They they were, I had a lot of kind of what you'd call now very eccentric relatives. That my Uncle Ed made kelp candy, and
was it sweet?
It was awful. It was awful. And
so it was sweetened somehow.
And I don't even know, it was awful.
That's the only memory.
And my aunt Evelyn made, you know, she was like making rosehip tea and stuff, mm-hmm. back, you know, when we all thought this was a really strange lady, you know, that did this stuff. But yeah. And then it became, you know, 20, 30 years later, it was a popular thing to do. But the kelp candy never caught on. But, but he did harvest kelp and put it around his garden and stuff. Mm-hmm. And all my family, they were just terrific gardeners and you know, growing flowers and growing vegetables and stuff. It's just kind of, like I said, I started just following these old boys around and watching them, listening, and helping them. Then when I was, we for fun, when we were, I remember I when I was about 17, I was working on the reef net gear, and I bought a 1948 Chevy convertible. Ooh. With a split manifold. Wow. Oh, it was the sweetest car.
Wow.
And I remember that winter, Charlie Washburn and I driving around, somebody else might have been with us too, but driving around in a Northeaster with the top down, sitting up, seeing how long we could, taking turns, sitting up on the top of the, sitting on the back of the seat with our heads above the things, how long we could take it and stay up there, you know, and without freezing. And that's kind of how pathetic it
sounds.
It was.
Like, no, you know, actually, that sounds like a lot of fun.
But there was a lot of card playing. It was a lot of the social things where a couple times a week people would be over, or we would be at somebody else's house. My folks played cards, and we would, we had record players, and we would dance and play cards. And when we were little, we played horses, and we played in the woods. We built forts, and we built. We didn't have horses, so we would take these little calves out of the barn and fill gunny sacks full of stuff and hang old coffee pots and pans and pretend that they were our pack horses, and we would drag them around the farm and we even tried hooking them up and trying to make oxen out of them, but that didn't work out very well. they weren't good. But I got drugged pretty bad one time playing around like that. I got the loop and leg. The rope caught around my foot, and the calf drugged me until I hit a tree. And yet, needless to say, I didn't walk very well for a few days. It was not fun.
Not
I was
a
about,
good thing.
About 8 or 9 years old. Wow. It was pretty sore. Mm. But so much of what we did was involved with farming. You know, you'd be hauling hay with your friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so... or you'd be picking rock with your friends in the winter. You might be doing that, or you'd be digging a ditch. Or there wasn't a lot of construction at that time. There would be maybe 2, 3, maybe 5 houses or mm-hmm. something built, or somebody would build a barn or something like that. So sometimes we'd get a little job helping pour concrete, and because mm-hmm. there was no the original, when we poured, I started working at the Ellis Ranch where they poured concrete. We had 2 little mixers that went on the back of tractors, and they were like a half a yard or something like that. And this was like state of the art stuff. Instead of having the old hand mixer where you know, it was electric and you dumped it in the wheelbarrow and wheeled it, this way you put all the stuff in there and drove the tractor up to the thing and dumped it. And it was like, wow, that was great, you know. And then Dick Pickering's dad started the ready mix thing. And we're talking about the mid to early 60s when this started. And then that's when construction started going, and there started being more jobs in construction and stuff. And
did you enjoy construction?
Well, it was, there was nothing else to do. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to make a living here, there was, you know, you couldn't, farming was so... Farming got really bad in the 60s and early 70s. It got really, you know, you couldn't make a living at it. And unfortunately, that's what I wanted to do. But I never could get enough, I couldn't generate enough income. So I had to go work in construction. And gradually, I got, you know, I worked off and on for different people. And and I gradually got into concrete work, and that's kind of where I ended up. And when I quit, was being a concrete guy. But
and now, are you farming? Is that what you're?
Well, I'm supposed to be doing more of it, but it isn't really working that way. But we have about 70 ewes, and I work for Cape St. Mary Ranch with Scottish Highland Cattle. I'm a herdsman for that, and because of my farming stuff and pruning and learning all the farm machinery and stuff, it's really been a real asset. I work at the cemetery and I do the maintenance there, so you know, you're mowing and working with things, and because of the construction stuff, I can make repairs on buildings and do stuff. You know, when I grew up as a kid, there was not really, we couldn't afford to have somebody come and fix it for you, so you had to fix it yourself somehow. And so you just learned to do a lot of things. Can't say I can do them all well, but it's been a real hard thing to do, is, you know, because I was, you know, thought you fix it. Well, I'm having to learn now that I'm better off maybe to get an expert to fix it and do the things that I'm really good at and get somebody else instead of, you know, they can do it. Yeah, it costs more money, but they can do it in way less time. It still takes me 3 or 4 trips to the hardware store to do a plumbing project.
But that's common. So. Everybody does that.
Sometimes I'm really glad we live as close to the hardware store as we do.
But yeah. We did, you know, I think what two of the biggest rewarding things that I've done in my life would probably be my association with kids, my own and other people's, and through 4-H and music. Music has always been a big part of my life, and I love to sing, and I love to play, and I like to do things with kids, and acting too. Acting was, you know, that's what I studied in college. I started out, I was going to be an English teacher, and then I got in my first play and I was hooked. And but that's a different sort of thing. That's more of a stepping outside of yourself and being something that you're, you know, you get to be somebody that you're not, you know, you get to be somebody totally different. It's like reading a book. It's like you're getting wrapped up in the adventure. Mm-hmm. You know, you are, you're, you know, like I got to be Pa Joe in the Grapes of Wrath, you know, and I was John Proctor in the Crucible, you know, mm-hmm. and I got to be Romeo's father, you know. Neat, interesting characters that you know, that
you can really get into.
Well, you get to be somebody who's not a farmer, mm-hmm. fisherman, whatever, you know. It's fun. It gives me.
It's really enjoyable to see you on stage, and little that I've also known of your music, it's. I love the fact that you're a farmer and a singer and a actor and probably a dancer too. I don't know.
I like to dance. As a kid, I wanted to be a choreographer when I was like early teens. I used to watch the June Taylor dances on one of the shows, I forget now, like Jackie Gleason or somebody like that, you know, and they did all these elaborate things, and it was really cool, and I thought, you know, that would be so much fun to be that creative and generate that. But you know what? In the early 50s and the early 60s, boys didn't dance. My sister got piano lessons and tap dance lessons, I don't know if she still does either one of them or not, but you know, I would have liked to, but I don't even know if I even told anybody, because it just wasn't something. I was really involved in art. I still can draw a little. I lost a lot of my technique, but when I was in school, that was my thing. I was like the school all through from about second grade until I graduated. I drew a lot, and I was pretty decent. That was before I got into acting.
Yeah.
I think you gotta.
Well, it's an outlet. I mean, I find whether you're a writer, an artist, a musician, or a potter, or you plant garden, it's some way of expressing or
But all these things are, even like what I do a lot now in farming is I am now the old guy. I'm the one that you know, I used to go to people. Even a couple of years ago, there were still people I could go to, but they're gone now. So, but I look around, people are coming to me, and so, well, all these things that I've done is it's communicating. You know, the singing is communicating. It's the acting is communicating. The drawing, the you know, all those things are working with kids and all that. It's communication and expressing yourself better in different ways, because there's lots of ways people can learn. And I guess my wife says I'm always teaching. I'm always, you know, I don't even know I'm doing it, but I'm just always, it's always going on. I'm always teaching something. So, and I don't know where that came from, but.
Well, it came from your grandfather teaching you. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
You know, the way that kind of teaching happens is actually, you know, fantastic. And they're beginning now more and more to have people, what do you call that when they come, like an apprentice kind of thing, that kind of went out totally. And now they realize that that is the way to learn, mm-hmm. to be with somebody who knows how to do it.
My mentors were very important to me. You know, I mean, just, you know, they were guys that did things that I wanted to learn, and they I thank God all the time that they had enough patience to, because, you know, what fun is it to have a, you know, I mean, I know it's not, raising my own kids and stuff, it's not fun to have some little kid tagging around behind you all the time, getting in the way, and you got to keep looking out for him. And, you know, I mean, I could have gotten seriously hurt or whatever, because we were doing, I remember being with Billy Burt one time, and we were out moving some stock, and there's this huge big shorthorn bull, and he says, okay, now, he said, this bull's really proddy. He said, so what we're going to do is we're going to run at the bull as hard as we can. He's going to stop, and he's going to put his head down, and he's going to throw dirt, but we're going to keep running right at him, yell and scream and wave your hands. He said, because that's the only way we're going to, because if we show any kind, he's going to get us, you know. You know what? It worked, and it still works so far, because I'm still here, and I've done it dozens of times, but, you know, it's just
scary.
You know, it could have been, because there was no, I remember my brother working in the field one time, and a bull was coming at him, and he said, well, he said, I always heard that when the bulls charge, they're going to shut their eyes. He said, so I was watching, you know, waiting for him to shut his eyes, and pretty soon I'm on the ground, and he still hasn't shut his eyes. So you don't want to wait that long. You got to take the initiative away from him. Mm. And, you know, it's so far it's worked, but a lot of things that we did were really dangerous, I guess, you know, because there was no safety shields on anything. We were driving, you know, the mechanical ability of a lot of the vehicles that we worked around, you know, just putting the simple thing of stacking up bales, you know, they can fall down. I've had people get injured, you know, falling. We got hurt sometimes, you know, guys would break an arm or whatever. I never did, but you know, we were, part of it was luck, and part of it is my dad not being able to see when I did work around him was meticulous. If he put it down, you don't touch it. Yeah,
because he will want to
find
it again.
He wants to know exactly where it is.
Yeah.
You make sure before, you know, when he would go in to fall a tree, he was absolutely certain, I have an escape route, this is where I'm going to go, the tree's supposed to go there, what happens if it gets hung up, what happens if this, he would think all this stuff through, and he just instilled in me, you know, not that you don't do dangerous things, but you remove as many of the risks as you can, mm-hmm. so that you mm-hmm. only, you know, you don't, I remember I was on the boat working on the seiners and stuff I worked on and off for about 20 years on seine boats. Fishing, and I used to get so disgusted with guys when they go in and out of the seine skiff, they would step in the coil of line.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Two things that happened, and it did happen occasionally. I remember once We were going down, and all of a sudden somebody looked back, and the skiff had come unhooked, and we had set, 100 feet of net, and the skiff is sitting back there, and and we were going 8 knots down the channel, and it just, something happened, and it came loose. And or you'll get your foot tangled in it and foul it up. So when we did set it, then there was a big mess, So you just, gotta be careful, You gotta, not that you don't do things.
Unaware.
Yeah, you just, it's part of knowing what you're doing. It was fun to grow up here because, I can remember when we did have a lot of downtime. Our parents didn't. That's one thing I think parents do now. Every kid, they got to go here, they got to go there, they got to take them to this, they got to take them to that. When I was a kid, we spent a lot of time just playing in the dirt outside the house with our. We didn't even have real cars and trucks. We had stuff that we had made, or somebody else had made for us. We spent a lot of time lying in a hammock. And when I got my work done, I'd go lie in the hammock in the grove and read a book. Treasure Island and Grapes of Wrath and just different books like that, and letting my mind just completely wander. I'd go get on a leaky old boat and go out in the back of Hummel Lake back into the marshes and just sit there and drift around and pretend I was a pirate or whatever. There was a lot of structure, but it was, most of the structure was around work. It wasn't around our play. Play was just our time.
And nobody worried about where you were because everything was just fine. Nowadays, parents worry about where the children are.
I could go anywhere I wanted to, on anybody's property I wanted to, without question. I never thought about it. I think they did. And if they were moving their cows, you helped them. If their cow was out, you put it in. I would go down the road and somebody had something going on, I'd just stop and help them, And if I was doing something, people would stop and help me. Interesting thing about the waving thing, just a little aside. My cousin was driving a truck back and forth all day, and every time he'd go by, and I was building some fence out in front, so he would wave and I would wave and we'd grin at each other. He'd wave and I would wave. He would wave and I would wave. He would wave and I would wave. And one time, I don't know what was going on, I had a board was kind of busy or something. I knew he was coming, but I didn't look up and wave. And the next day, he stopped me. What's wrong? How come you didn't wave?
See, I think that with the waving, we will have to end this hour because Larry could go on. And I am very tempted to ask him to come again and tell us more.
I'd love to. I have a lot of relatives here. I grew up here. I knew a lot of the old boys. I know a lot of anecdotes and things like that. So it would be fun to do that.
Great. That is very nice. So we will have another opportunity to listen to Larry.
Well, thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening.